TED Audio Collective.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big? Summarize with AI in a click. Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply. This show is brought to you by Schwab. With Schwab investing themes, it's easy to invest in ideas you believe in, like electric vehicles, renewable energy, water sustainability, and more. Choose from over 40 themes. Buy as is or customize the stocks in a theme to fit your goals. Learn more at schwab.com/thematic investing.
Like TED Talks? You should check out the TED Radio Hour with NPR. Stay tuned after this talk to hear a sneak peek of this week's episode.
This TED Talk features serial entrepreneur Elon Musk in conversation with TED curator Chris Anderson, recorded live at TED 2017.
Elon, hey, welcome back to TED. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So, in the next half hour or so, we're going to spend some time exploring your vision for what an exciting future might look like, which I guess makes the first question a little ironic. Why are you boring?
Yeah, I ask myself that frequently. We're trying to dig a hole under LA, and this is to create the beginning of what will hopefully be a 3D network of tunnels to alleviate congestion. So, I mean, right now, I think one of the most soul-destroying things is traffic. It affects people in every part of the world. It takes away so much of your life, and it's horrible. It's particularly horrible in LA.
I think you've brought with you the first visualization that's been shown of this. Can I show this?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the first time. Yeah, we've just to sort of show what we're talking about. So there are a couple of key things that are important in having a 3D tunnel network. First of all, you have to be able to integrate the entrance and exit of the tunnel seamlessly into the fabric of a city. So by having an elevator, sort of a car skate that's on an elevator, you can integrate the entrance and exits to the tunnel network by using two parking spaces. And then the car gets on a skate. There's no speed limit here. So we're designing this to be able to operate at 200 kilometers an hour, about 130, 200 kilometers an hour, or about 130 miles per hour. So you should be able to get from, say, Westwood to LAX in 6 minutes, 5-6 minutes.
So possibly initially done, it's like on a sort of toll road type basis.
Yeah.
Which I guess alleviates some traffic from the surface streets as well.
So I think, I don't know if people noticed it in the video, but there's no real limit to how many levels of tunnel you can have. So you can go much further deep than you can go up. The deepest mines are much deeper than the tallest buildings are tall. So you can alleviate any arbitrary level of urban congestion with a 3D tunnel network. This is a very important point. So a key rebuttal to the tunnels is that if you add one layer of tunnels, then that will simply alleviate congestion, will get used up, and then you'll be back where you started, back with congestion. But you can go to any arbitrary number of tunnels, any number of levels.
But people assume traditionally it's incredibly expensive to dig, and that would block this idea.
Yeah. Well, they're right. To give you an example, the LA subway extension, which is, I think it's a 2.5-mile extension that was just completed for $2 billion. So it's roughly $1 billion a mile to do the subway extension in LA. And this is not the highest utility subway in the world. It's quite difficult to dig tunnels normally. I think we need to have at least a tenfold improvement in the cost per mile of tunneling.
And how could you achieve that?
I guess, if you just do two things, you can get to approximately an order of magnitude improvement, and I think you can go beyond that. So the first thing to do is to cut the tunnel diameter by a factor of two or more. So a single road lane tunnel would, according to regulations, has to be 26 feet, maybe 28 feet in diameter to allow for crashes and emergency vehicles and sufficient ventilation for combustion engine cars. But if you shrink that diameter to what we're attempting, which is 12 feet, which is plenty to get an electric skate through, you drop the diameter by a factor of two and the cross-sectional area by a factor of four. So and the tunneling cost scales with the cross-sectional area. So that's roughly a half order of magnitude improvement right there. Then tunneling machines currently tunnel for half the time, then they stop, and then the rest of the time is putting in reinforcements for the tunnel wall. So if you design the machine instead to do continuous tunneling and reinforcing, that'll give you a factor of two improvement. Combine that and it's a factor of eight. Also, these machines are far from being at their power or thermal limit. So you can jack up the power to the machine substantially. I think you can get at least a factor of two, maybe a factor of four or five improvement on top of that. So I think there's a fairly straightforward series of steps to get somewhere in excess of an order of magnitude improvement in the cost per mile. Our target actually is we've got a pet snail called Gary. This is from Gary the Snail from South Park. SpongeBob SquarePants. So Gary is capable of currently he's capable of going 14 times faster than a tunnel boring machine. Okay.
You want to beat Gary?
We want to beat Gary. Yeah. He's not a patient little fellow, and we want that will be victory. Victory is beating the snail.
But a lot of people dreaming about future cities, they imagine that the solution is sort of flying cars, drones, etc. You go above ground. Why isn't that a better solution? You save all that tunneling cost.
Right. I'm in favor of flying things. Obviously, I do rockets, so I like things that fly. This is not some inherent bias against flying things, but there is a challenge with flying cars in that they'll be quite noisy. The wind force generated will be very high. Let's just say that if something's flying over your head, if there are a whole bunch of flying cars going all over the place, that is not an anxiety-reducing situation. You don't think to yourself, well, I feel better about today. You're thinking, like, did they service their hubcap? Or is it going to come off and guillotine me as they're flying past?
So you've got this vision, then, future cities with these rich 3D networks of tunnels underneath. Is there a tie in here with Hyperloop? Could you apply these tunnels to use for this Hyperloop idea you released a few years ago?
Yeah, so we've been sort of puttering around with the Hyperloop stuff for a while. We built a Hyperloop test track adjacent to SpaceX just for a student competition to encourage innovative ideas in transport. It actually ends up being the biggest vacuum chamber in the world after the Large Hadron Collider by volume. It was sort of quite fun to do that, but it was kind of a hobby thing. And then we think we might. So we developed a little pusher car to push the student pods, but we're going to try seeing how fast we can make the pusher go if it's not pushing something. So. I mean, like, sort of cautiously optimistic, we'll be able to be faster than the world's fastest bullet train, even in a 0.8-mile stretch.
Whoa. Good brakes.
Yeah. I mean, it's either going to smash into tiny pieces or
But you can picture then a Hyperloop in a tunnel, running quite long distances.
Exactly. So in looking at tunneling technology, it turns out that in order to make a tunnel, you have to, in order to seal against the water table, you've got to typically design a tunnel wall to be a good to about 5 or 6 atmospheres. So to go to vacuum is only 1 atmosphere, or near vacuum. So actually, it sort of turns out that automatically, if you build a tunnel that is good enough to resist the water table, it is automatically capable of holding vacuum.
Huh.
So, yeah.
And so you can actually picture this, like what kind of length tunnel is in Elon's future to running Hyperloop?
Yeah, I think there's no real length limit. You could dig as much as you want. I think if you were to do something like a DC to New York Hyperloop, I think you'd probably want to go underground the entire way because it's a high density area. You're going under a lot of buildings and houses, and if you go deep enough, you cannot detect the tunnel. Sometimes people think, well, it's going to be pretty annoying to have a tunnel dug under my house. Like if that tunnel is dug more than about 3 or 4 tunnel diameters beneath your house, you will not be able to detect it being dug at all. If you're able to detect the tunnel being dug, whatever device you're using, you can get a lot of money for that device from the Israeli military, who is trying to detect tunnels from Hamas, and from the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol that are trying to detect drug tunnels. So the reality is that Earth is incredibly good at absorbing vibrations, and once the tunnel depth is below a certain level, it is undetectable. Maybe if you have a very sensitive seismic instrument, you might be able to detect it.
So you've started a new company to do this called The Boring Company. Very nice, very, right. Very funny.
What's funny about that?
How much of your time is this?
It's maybe 2 or 3%.
You've called it a hobby. This is what an Elon Musk hobby looks like.
I mean, it really is. Like, we actually, you know, this is basically interns and people doing it part time. So this is we bought some secondhand machinery, and it's kind of puttering along, but it's making good progress. So
an even bigger part of your time is being spent on electrifying cars and transport through Tesla. Is one of the motivations for the tunneling project the realization that actually, in a world where cars are electric and where they're self-driving, there may end up being more cars on the roads on any given hour than there are now.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people think that when you make cars autonomous, that they'll be able to go faster and that will alleviate congestion. And to some degree, that will be true. But once you have shared autonomy where it's much cheaper to go by car and you can go point to point, the affordability of going in a car will be better than that of a bus. Like, it'll cost less than a bus ticket. So the amount of driving that'll occur will be much greater with shared autonomy, and actually traffic will get far worse.
I mean, you started Tesla with the goal of persuading the world that electrification was the future of cars.
Yeah.
And a few years ago, people were laughing at you. Now, not so much. I mean...
Okay.
Well, I mean, isn't it...
I don't know.
Maybe some, but isn't it true that pretty much every auto manufacturer has announced serious electrification plans for the short to medium term future?
Yeah. I think almost every automaker has some electric vehicle program. They vary in seriousness. Some are very serious about transitioning entirely to electric, and some are just dabbling in it. And some, amazingly, are still pursuing fuel cells, but I think that won't last much longer.
But isn't there a sense, though, Elon, where you could now just declare victory and say, you know, we did it, let the world electrify, and you go on and focus on other stuff?
Yeah. I intend to stay with Tesla as far into the future as I can imagine. There are a lot of exciting things that we have coming. We've got obviously Model 3 that's coming soon. We'll be unveiling the Tesla semi truck.
We're gonna come to this. So Model 3. So it's coming. It's supposed to be coming in July-ish.
Yeah, it's looking quite good for starting production in July. Yeah.
Wow. One of the things that people are so excited about is the fact that it's got autopilot. And you put out this video a while back showing what that technology looked like or would look like.
Yeah.
There's obviously autopilot in Model S right now. Yeah. What are we seeing here?
Yeah, so this is using only cameras and a GPS. So there's no LiDAR or radar being used here. This is just using passive optical, which is essentially what a person uses. The whole road system is meant to be navigated with passive optical or cameras. And so once you solve cameras or vision, then autonomy is solved. If you don't solve vision, it's not solved. So that's why our focus is so heavily on having a vision neural net that's very effective for road conditions.
Right. Many other people are going the LiDAR route. You want cameras plus radar is most of it.
You can absolutely be superhuman with just cameras. Like, you could probably do 10 times better than humans with just cameras.
So the new cars being sold right now have eight cameras in them. That they can't yet do what that showed. When will they be able to?
I think we're still on track for being able to go cross-country from L.A. to New York by the end of the year, fully autonomous.
So a car, by the end of the year, you're saying someone's going to sit in a Tesla without touching the steering wheel, tap in New York, off it goes, won't have to ever touch the wheel by the end of 2017.
Yeah, essentially November or December of this year, we should be able to go from, all the way from a parking lot in California to a parking lot in New York, no controls touched at any point during the entire journey.
And amazing. But part of that is possible because you've already got a fleet of Teslas driving all these roads. You're accumulating a huge amount of data of that national road system.
Yes, but the thing that will be interesting is that I'm actually fairly confident it will be able to do that route, even if you change the route dynamically. So, like, it's fairly easy. Or if you say I'm going to be really good at one specific route, that's one thing. But it should be able to go really be very good. Certainly, once you enter a highway, to go anywhere on the highway system in a given country. So it's not sort of limited to LA, New York. We could change it, and make it Seattle, Florida, that day, or in real time. So you were going from LA to New York. Now go from LA to Toronto.
So leaving aside regulation for a second, that in terms of the technology alone, the time when someone will be able to buy one of your cars and literally just take their hands off the wheel and go to sleep and wake up and find that they've arrived. How far away is that to do that safely?
I think that's about 2 years. The real trick of it is not, how do you make it work, say, 99.9% of the time? Because if a car crashes, say, 1 in 1,000 times, then you're probably still not going to be comfortable falling asleep. You shouldn't be, certainly. it's never going to be perfect. No system is going to be perfect. But if you say it's perhaps, the car is unlikely to crash in 100 lifetimes or 1,000 lifetimes, then people are like, okay, wow. If I would live 1,000 lives, I would still most likely never experience a crash. Then that's probably okay.
I guess a big concern of yours is that people may actually get seduced too early to think that this is safe and that you'll have some horrible incident happen that puts things back.
Well, I think that the autonomy system is likely to at least mitigate the crash, except in rare circumstances. The thing to appreciate about vehicle safety is this is probabilistic. Right. So that there is I mean, there's some chance that any time a human driver gets in the car, that they will have an accident. That is their fault. Hmm. It's never zero. And so the key threshold for autonomy is how much better does autonomy need to be than a person before you can rely on it?
But once you get that literally safe hands-off driving, the power to disrupt the whole industry seems massive, because at that point, you've spoken of people being able to buy a car, drops you off at work, and then you let it go and provide a sort of Uber-like service to other people, earn you money, maybe even cover the cost of your lease of that car.
Exactly.
So you can kind of get a car for free. Is that really likely?
Yeah, absolutely this is what will happen. So there will be a shared autonomy fleet where you buy your car and you can choose to use that car exclusively. You could choose to have it be used only by friends and family, only by other drivers who are rated 5-star. You can choose to share it sometimes, but not other times. That's 100% what will occur. It's just a question of when.
Wow. So you mentioned the semi, and I think you're planning to announce this in September. But I'm curious whether there's anything you could show us today.
I will show you a teaser shot of the of the truck.
Teaser shot.
It's alive.
Okay.
Now, you know, that's definitely a case where we want to be cautious about the autonomy features.
Because that just, we can't see that much of it, but it doesn't look like just a little friendly neighborhood truck. It looks kind of badass. What sort of semi is this?
So this is a heavy-duty, long-range semi-truck. So it's like the highest weight capability and with long range. So essentially it's meant to alleviate the heavy-duty trucking loads. And this is something which people do not today think is possible. You think the truck doesn't have enough power or it doesn't have enough range. And then with the Tesla Semi, we want to show that an electric truck actually can out-torque any diesel semi. If you had a tug-of-war competition, the Tesla Semi will tug the diesel semi uphill.
That's pretty cool. And short-term, these aren't driverless. These are going to be trucks that truck drivers want to drive.
Yes. What'll be really fun about this is you have a flat torque RPM curve with an electric motor, whereas with a diesel motor or any kind of internal combustion engine car, you've got a torque RPM curve that looks like a hill. So this will be a very spry truck. You could drive this around like a sports car. There's no gears. It's like single speed. So
there's a great movie to be made here somewhere. I don't know what it is, and I don't know that it ends well, but it's a great movie.
I mean, it's quite bizarre test driving when I was driving the test prototype for this truck. It's really weird because you're driving around and you're so nimble, and you're in this giant truck.
Wait, you've already driven a prototype?
I drove it around the parking lot. I was like, this is crazy.
Wow. This is not vaporware.
This is like wow. Driving this giant truck and sort of making these mad maneuvers.
This is cool. Okay, from a really badass picture to a kind of less badass picture, this is just a cute house from Desperate Housewives or something. What on earth is going on here?
Well, this illustrates the picture of the future that I think is how things will evolve. You've got an electric car in the driveway. If you look in between the electric car and the house, there are actually 3 power walls stacked up against the side of the house. And then that house roof is a solar roof. So that's an actual solar glass roof.
Okay, so those
That's a picture of a real... admittedly, it's a real fake house. That's a real fake house.
So these roof tiles, some of them have in them basically solar power, the ability to...
Yeah, so the solar glass tiles where you can adjust the texture and the color at a very fine-grained level, and then there are sort of micro-louvers in the glass such that when you're looking at the roof from street level or close to street level, all the tiles look the same whether there is a solar panel behind it, or a solar cell behind it, or not. So you have an even color from the ground level. If you were to look at it from a helicopter, you would be actually able to look through and see that some of the glass tiles have a solar cell behind them and some do not.
Right. You put them in the ones that are likely to see a lot of sun.
Yes.
And that makes these roofs super affordable, right? They're not that much more expensive than just tiling the roof.
Yeah. We're very confident that the cost of the roof plus the cost of electricity, a solar glass roof will be less than the cost of a normal roof plus the cost of electricity. So in other words, this will be economically a no-brainer. We think it will look great, and it will last. We thought about having the warranty be infinity, but then people thought, well, that might sound like we were just talking rubbish. But actually, this is toughened glass. Like well after the house has collapsed. And there's nothing there. The roof will tie, the glass tiles will still be there.
Yeah, so I think you're rolling. This is cool. You're rolling this out in a couple weeks' time, I think, with four different roofing types.
Yeah, we're starting off with two initially, and then the second two will be introduced early next year.
And what's the scale of ambition here? How many houses do you believe could end up having this type of roofing?
I mean, I think eventually almost all houses will have a solar roof. The thing is to consider the timescale here to be probably on the order of 40 or 50 years. So on average, a roof is replaced every 20 to 25 years. So, but you don't start replacing all roofs immediately. But eventually, if you say we were to fast forward to say 15 years from now, it will be unusual to have a roof that does not have solar.
Is there a mental model thing that people don't get here that there's been, because of the shift in the sort of cost economics of solar power, that like most houses actually have enough sunlight on their roof pretty much to power all of their needs? If you could capture the power, yeah, it could pretty much power all their needs, right? You could go off grid, kind of.
Yeah, it depends on where you are and what the house size is relative to the roof area. But yeah, it's a fair statement to say that most houses in the U.S. have enough roof area to power all the needs of the house.
Okay, so the key to the economics of the cars, the semi, these houses, is the falling price of lithium-ion batteries, which you've made a huge bet on as Tesla. In many ways, that's almost the core competency. And you've decided that to really own that competency, you just have to build the world's largest manufacturing plant, kind of double the world's supply of lithium-ion batteries.
Yeah,
with this guy. What is this?
Yeah, so that's the Gigafactory. The progress so far in the Gigafactory. Eventually, you can sort of roughly see that there's sort of a diamond shape overall. When it's fully done, it'll look like a giant diamond. Well, that's the idea behind it. And it's aligned on true north. There's a small detail, but
and capable of producing like 100, eventually like 100 gigawatt hours of batteries a year.
100 gigawatt hours. We think probably more, but yeah.
And they're actually being produced right now already here, right?
They're in production already.
You guys put out this video.
Yeah.
I mean, is that speeded up or?
That's the slowed down version.
Is that how fast does it actually go?
Well, when it's running at full speed, you can't actually see the cells without a strobe light. It's just blur.
one of your core ideas, Elon, about what makes an exciting future is a future where we no longer feel guilty about energy. Help us picture this. I mean, how many gigafactories, if you like, does it take to get us there?
It's about 100, roughly. It's not 10, it's not 1,000, most likely 100.
See, I kind of find this amazing. Like, you can actually picture, if that's right, you can picture what it would take to move the world off this vast fossil fuel thing. It's like you're building one, cost $5 billion, maybe the next one, or whatever, $5 to $10 billion. Yeah. Like, it's... It's kind of cool that you can picture that project. And you're planning to do a Tesla, or at least announce another two this year.
I think we'll announce locations for somewhere between 2 and 4 gigafactories later this year. Yeah, probably 4.
Whoa. Yeah. Okay. I can't tease. No more teasing from you for here. Like, where? Continent? you can say no.
We need to address a global market.
Yeah. Okay. This is cool. I think we should talk for... Actually, global market. So I have to ask you one question. I'm going to ask you one question about politics. Only one. I'm kind of sick of politics, but I do need to ask you this. You're on a body now giving advice to a guy who has said he doesn't really believe in climate change. And there's a lot of people out there who kind of think you shouldn't be doing that. They'd like you to walk away from that. What would you say to them?
Well, I think that first of all, I'm just on 2 advisory councils where the format consists of going around the room and asking people's opinion on things. And so there's like a meeting every month or two. You know, that's the sum total of my contribution. But I think to the degree that there are people in the room who are arguing in favor of doing something about climate change or, you know, other, you know, certain, you know, social issues, you know, I mean, I've used the meetings I've had thus far to argue in favor of immigration and in favor of climate change. And if I hadn't done that, that wasn't on the agenda before. So maybe nothing will happen, but at least the words were said.
Okay. So let's talk SpaceX and Mars. Last time you were here, you spoke about this, what seemed like a kind of incredibly ambitious dream to develop rockets that were actually reusable. And you've only gone and done it.
Yeah.
I mean,
talk us
through this. What are we looking at here?
Yeah, so this is one of our rocket boosters coming back from very, very high, very high and fast in space. So it just delivered the upper stage at high velocity. I think this may have been sort of a Mach 7 or so delivery of the upper stage.
So that was a sped up.
That's the slowed down version. Yeah.
That was the sped up version. But I mean, that's amazing. And several of these failed before you finally figured out how to get to do it. But now you've landed. You've done this what, 5 or 6 times?
I think we're on eight or nine, or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And for the first time, you've actually reflown one of the rockets that landed. So
we landed. Yeah, we landed the rocket booster and then prepped it for flight again and flew it again. So it's the first reflight of an orbital booster where that reflight is relevant. So it's important to appreciate that reusability is only relevant if it is rapid and complete.
Right.
So like an aircraft or a car, the reusability is rapid and complete. You do not send your aircraft into Boeing in between flights.
Right. So this is allowing you to dream of this really ambitious idea of sending like many, many, many people to Mars in 10 or 20 years, 20 years' time, I guess.
Yeah.
In the next 20 years. And you've designed this outrageous rocket to do it. Help us understand the scale of this thing.
Well, I think visually, you can see that person. Yeah, and that's the vehicle.
So if that was just a skyscraper, that's like a 40. Did I read that 40 stories?
Yeah, maybe a little more. Yeah. The thrust level of this is really this configuration is about 4 times the thrust of the Saturn V moon rocket.
4 times the thrust of the biggest rocket humanity ever created before.
Yeah. I mean,
as one does. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. I mean, in units of 747, like 747 is only about a quarter million pounds of thrust. So there are for every 10 million pounds of thrust, there's 47. So this would be the thrust equivalent of 127 47s with all engines blazing.
And so even with a machine designed to escape Earth's gravity, I think you told me last this thing could actually take a fully loaded 747, people, cargo, everything, into orbit.
Exactly. This can take a fully loaded 747 with maximum fuel, maximum passengers, maximum cargo on the 747. This can take it as cargo.
So based on this, you presented recently this interplanetary transport system, which is visualized this way. And this is a scene you picture, what, in 30th time, 20th time? People walking into this rocket.
I mean, I'm hopeful it's sort of in the eight to 10-year time frame. Aspirationally, that's our target. Our internal targets are more aggressive, but I think...
Okay.
So well, this vehicle seems quite large, and is large by comparison with other rockets. I think the future spacecraft will make this look like a rowboat. I mean, this is the future spaceships will be truly enormous.
Why, Elon? Why do we need to build a city on Mars with a million people on it in your lifetime, which I think is kind of what you've said you'd love to do?
Yeah, I think it's important to have a future that is inspiring and appealing. I mean, I just think that there have to be reasons that you get up in the morning and you want to live. Like, why do you want to live? What's the point? What inspires you? What do you love about the future? And if we're not out there, if the future does not include being out there among the stars, and being a multi-planet species, I find that it's incredibly depressing if that's not the future that we're going to have.
People want to position this as an either-or, that there are so many desperate things happening on the planet now, from climate to poverty to, you know, you pick your issue. And this feels like a distraction. You shouldn't be thinking about this. You should be solving what's here and now. And to be fair, you've done a fair old bit to actually do that with your, you know, work on sustainable energy. But why not just do that?
Well, I think I look at the future from a standpoint of the probabilities. It's like a branching stream of probabilities. And there are actions that we can take that affect those probabilities, or that accelerate one thing or slow down another thing, or make, you know, introduce something new to the probability stream. Sustainable energy will happen no matter what. If there was no Tesla, if Tesla never existed, it would have to happen out of necessity. It's tautological. If you don't have sustainable energy, it means you have unsustainable energy. Eventually, you'll run out, and the laws of economics will drive civilization towards sustainable energy inevitably. The fundamental value of a company like Tesla is the degree to which it accelerates the advent of sustainable energy faster than it would otherwise occur. So when I think, like, what is the fundamental good of a company like Tesla, I would say hopefully it does. If it accelerated that by a decade, potentially more than a decade, that would be quite a good thing to occur. That's what I consider to be the fundamental sort of aspirational good of Tesla. Then there's becoming a multi-planet species and spacefaring civilization. This is not inevitable. It's very important to appreciate this is not inevitable. The sustainable energy future, I think, is largely inevitable, but being space-faring civilization is definitely not inevitable. If you look at the progress in space, in 1969, we were able to send somebody to the moon. 1969. Mm. Then we had the space shuttle. The space shuttle could only take people to low Earth orbit. Mm. Then the space shuttle retired, and the United States could take no one to orbit. So that's the trend. The trend is like down to nothing. This is not... People are mistaken when they think that technology just automatically improves. It does not automatically improve. It only improves if a lot of people work very hard to make it better. And actually, it will, I think, it by itself degrade, actually. Mm. You look at great civilizations like ancient Egypt, and they're able to make the pyramids, and they forgot how to do that. Mm. And the Romans, they built these incredible aqueducts. They forgot how to do it.
You know, it almost seems, you know, listening to you and look at the different things you've done, that you've got this unique double motivation on everything that I find so interesting. Which is, one is this desire to work for humanity's long-term good. The other is this desire to do something exciting. And it's often, it feels like you feel like you need the one to drive the other. With Tesla, you want to have sustainable energy, so you make these super sexy, exciting cars to do it. You know, solar energy, we need to get there, so we need to make these beautiful roofs. We haven't even spoken about your newest thing, which we don't even have time to do, but you want to save humanity from bad AI, and so you're going to create this really cool brain-machine interface to give us all infinite memory and telepathy and so forth. And on Mars, it feels like what you're saying is, yeah, we need to save humanity and have a backup plan, but also we need to inspire humanity, and this is a way to inspire.
I think the value of beauty and inspiration is very much underrated, no question. But I want to be clear. I'm not trying to be anyone's savior. That is not the. I'm just trying to think about the future and not be sad.
Beautiful statement. I think everyone here would agree that it is not, none of this is going to happen inevitably. The fact that in your mind you dream this stuff, you dream stuff that no one else would dare dream, or no one else would be capable of dreaming at the level of complexity that you do. The fact that you do that, Elon Musk, is a really remarkable thing. Thank you for helping us all to dream a bit bigger.
You'll tell me if it ever starts getting genuinely insane, right?
Thank you. That was really, really fantastic.
For more TED Talks, go to TED.com.
20 years ago, Jimmy Wales founded Wikipedia as a place for everyone to share information. But he wasn't exactly sure how to run the site.
How do you put together a system that will generate a reasonable degree of quality and, you know, be open?
Ideas about building communities, online and off. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Subscribe or listen to the TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts. PRX.